It is with great relish today that I share with you an underground pamphlet from 1964 called The Beginner's Guide to Cruising by George Marshall. Where did I find such a choice piece of pre-Stonewall ephemera? Well, it's because of my recent work with the Cornell Human Sexuality Collection. They have recently received a donation from a man named Harry Weintraub. It's a huge collection. He's a New York City labor lawyer, still alive today, and he took more than three decades to amass his collection of 20,000 gay-themed photographs and what we call print items, pamphlets, even actually little vinyl records and record sleeves, postcards, matchbooks, everything. It's a treasure trove. Some of them date back all the way to the 1860s, and they range from formal 19th century portraits of men together to candid snapshots from Fire Island in the 50s. I got a special chance to look at Weintraub's collection when I was in New York City last week, and one of the items that caught my eye was this little booklet with a really hot guy in a leather jacket on the cover. You know, kind of a, he looked like, I would say, an Italian James Dean, a little bit of a pompadour, and he's standing next to a trap door. That's good. It, in big Helvetica, it says, The Beginner's Guide to Cruising. Now, I'm going to read you the first chapter, and you might want to take notes because this is unforgettable. And it also appears to be very hard to come by. I mean, of course I went on to Amazon because I want my own copy. But, and although I found it listed, no copies available. This thing must have been printed in very small numbers, and you'd be quite lucky if you got it. Now, some of you may be asking, okay, Susie, I'll bite on the historical interest, but really, how many of your listeners want to hear in detail about how to pick up gay men in 1964? Well, gosh, I am. Does anybody else really matter? But the thing is, as you listen to this, those of you who have ever picked up anyone or been picked up, flirted, cruised, gotten horny and hoped that something would happen, these words of wisdom, they would be very applicable to just about anyone. In fact, whenever he says gaze, he talks about looking for gaze to pick up, never describing himself as gay, which I find kind of confusing. But when he uses that word, he means young, hot men, young, pretty, hot men. And it's not about I'm trying to get married or I'm trying to find an older man my age who may not be in his prime. No, 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 no. This is about the pretty young things. And as I was reading it, I thought a lot about people who try to hook up with celebrities or supermodels, or just the view of the older person who knows that they're not the cutest thing anymore. They're not going to pull anyone in based on their looks, but they are specifically and maybe only attracted to young, good-looking people. How do you get those beautiful young creatures to pay attention to you when, you know, you're not in your glory, shall we say? This is the book that tells you. By the way, I should preface this by saying it was published by something called Guild Book Service, Box 7410, Franklin Station, Washington, D.C. Isn't that interesting? I thought it would be New York, but it's a Washington, D.C. address, and believe you me, it doesn't exist anymore. It was for sale, $3 a copy, and it was so successful that there is a sequel called The Advanced Guide to Cruising. But don't you think we're going to skip to that, because I don't think you have mastered the basics. Let us begin with Chapter 1, Tools and Equipment. It is just no good trying to do anything unless you have got the proper equipment. The do-it-yourselfer would be lost without his tools, and the would-be cruiser is in no better case. What, then, must one have? Apart from the obvious gay attributes, I would say that the cruiser needs time, freedom of action, a garçonnière, some money, the gift of gab, imagination, self-control, a certain amount of cruelty, a bit of acting capacity, discretion, some taste, and that's about all. You might have noticed that I have left out some of the characteristics which are generally linked to the conventional idea of the cruiser. He not need be tall, handsome, young, impeccably dressed, nor possess suave, courtly manners, extreme wealth, wit, and intelligence. They all help, of course, but fortunately, they are not as important as the more modest assets listed above. Oh, I almost forgot to say, the cruiser must like gays, but like them, really and truly enjoy their company and not just use them to bolster his ego or to show off. Gays are very sensitive and will very soon smell the insincere rat. Let us now analyze a little more closely what the cruiser must have. Time. The fact that to be a successful cruiser you shall need a lot of time will, I know, come as a shock to you, but there it is. It is an inescapable fact, and it had better be faced. Gay, more than straight, tend to be bored, and if you can dedicate a good chunk of your time to taking them out, accompanying them on little errands, keeping them occupied and amused, you will have won half the battle. A gay may be kept by the most handsome, brilliant, most passionate man, but if the man is too busy creating new hairstyles, mastering a new ballet step, or memorizing the latest folk song, so he can hardly find a few hours in the week to dedicate to his mate, it is extremely likely that he will fall into the arms of the first cruiser who has quite a lot of time on his hands. I have seen it happen dozens of times, and so probably have you. This applies particularly to those cities where gays, as a rule, don't work. The working gay is much more difficult to seduce than the idle one. If, as is probably the case, you don't have too much time available, you can resort to the trick of the indirect presence. Although the actual time you can spend with him is limited, you must make him feel your presence. Remind him of your existence as often as possible. Frequent phone calls, letters, or just a scribbled note, items of clothing and little presents judiciously spaced over the week will help. Ask him to watch a certain TV show or go to a certain play which you would have liked to see, but which you must miss because of your work, and then he must give you a report. Ask him to read a certain book, as you would like to know what he thinks of it. Ask him to try and find you a material suitable to cover a certain chair or a print to stick in the entrance, etc., etc. These little things will not only satisfy his vanity by implying that you rely on his judgment and good taste, but will also keep you in his mind. Isn't this interesting? Can't you just see yourself seducing Lindsay Lohan in this very manner? Freedom of action. This may not be quite the same thing as having time. For instance, you might be a man with a lot of leisure, able to dedicate all your afternoons and evenings to cruising gays. But if one of them rings you up at 11 o'clock, never before, I hope, telling you he would like to see you immediately, and if you feel that he is particularly in need of consolation and sympathy, and you cannot, because of your commitments, make it, it's just too bad. In the afternoon, his mood might have changed, and you will have missed the golden opportunity. Likewise, you should be ready and capable of leaving town, even for just a few days, or practically at any moment. Obviously, it's no use whispering passionately in a gay's rosy ear of how wonderful it would be if he and you could run away from it all and spend a few days in New York, Montreal, or the nearest hotel. If, after you have to reach for your agenda, consult it carefully, you add, what about the 15th to the 18th of September? You should be able to pounce at any time to turn up unexpectedly and, as it were, out of the blue just when he is staying with an old aunt in a provincial town and your Secret Service has informed you that he is utterly bored. In given circumstances, the most beautiful and haughty gay will welcome the arrival of a middle-aged, balding, plump friend as if he were a fairy godmother. Cruising, unlike Russia's economic development, cannot be planned on a 5-year or even a 5-week basis. It must be invented and improvised from day to day. Timing is an extremely important factor, and freedom of action, therefore, very valuable. Naturally, not everyone can chuck or change his job just for the sake of gays. But it would be wise to keep all this in mind when you are about to set out to conquer a gay you particularly like at a time when you are particularly busy. In the strategy of love, the offense must be continuous and sustained. If you think you can conquer a gay on the installment plan, approach him and make the first advances now, consolidate your position in 2 months, and reap the harvest after another couple of months, you are mistaken. Once the attack is launched, it must be pressed to conclusion as rapidly and determinedly as possible. Otherwise, you had better postpone it. Now, here comes the part that I didn't know anything about. It's called the garçonnière. I have never in my wildly literate life heard someone use this phrase before, and shame on me. I will let Mr. Marshall explain. He says, the very fact that the English language hasn't a word to indicate a place designed expressly for making love is significant. So that's what a garçonnière, it's a fuck flat, as it were. Back to Marshall. The European young man tends to live with his parents much longer than his Anglo-Saxon counterpart. I know many middle-aged bachelors in Italy who stay with mummy and daddy and are still called signorino by the servants and by ridiculously childish nicknames by family and friends. And the European cruiser tends to be more frequently unfaithful to his mate, though one is led to believe that American cruisers in particular are doing everything in their power to catch up. To complete the picture, I will say that gays have much less freedom in Palermo, say, than they have in New York, and that while registering in an English hotel as father and son is child's play, in Italy and Spain, you must produce your passports or identity cards to your companion's great annoyance and embarrassment. And I just have to add here, the whole context of this book is that homosexuality is illegal in every single country that Mr. Marshall is discussing. So, of course, discretion, if he is traveling in an old-fashioned country like Italy, is going to be even more critical. The consequence of all these restricting factors is that the French cruiser was compelled to invent the garçonnière, and Italian and Spanish colleagues have adopted the institution. While in a European country, the garçonnière is almost an essential item in the cruiser's equipment, in the Anglo-Saxon world, it can be mighty useful too. The choice of a garçonnière is important. It needn't be big, expensive, nor luxuriously furnished, nor especially decorated. Overdoing it might defeat its object. I remember the case of Marco B., a wealthy Milan industrialist who got himself the most splendid garçonnière in Rome. It had thick pile carpeting, pastel shades on the walls, subdued lights, slightly pornographic watercolors and drawings, including a witty car, a bar, a superb stereo with 4 or 5 loudspeakers concealed in the walls and in the ceiling, and a huge gilded alcove with an enormous Louis XV bed surrounded by mirrors on all sides. One day, he succeeded, after a long time, in luring a gay of great beauty and great taste into his den. The young man walked in, looked around, reflected a moment, blushed, turned on his heels, and left, saying, "I have never been so insulted in my life. Goodbye." My friend hadn't said a word, but the garçonnière had spoken for him, proclaiming much too loudly and blatantly the scope it was supposed to serve. But be careful not to go to the other extreme. A too monastic, drafty, uncomfortable, dirty, or shabby love nest can put off the best disposed of gays. Practically anything reasonably pleasant, and cozy will do. The main quality a garçonnière must have is discretion. It must not be too central, but also not too difficult to reach. An adulterous gay cannot spend too much time commuting. Should it be situated in a large apartment building, try to find one that can provide the gays who come to see you with an excuse for visiting it. The block of flats should contain a milliner, a hairdresser, a psychotherapist, an institute of Persian poetry, a yoga school, or what have you. A touch of the romantic would also help, such as a view over the rooftops. They'll think of themselves as Mimi and Bohème. A garden, or even a small roof garden. Painters' studios usually make very good garçonnières, and this is why, for instance, nearly all the painters have been turned out of the colorful Via Margutta in Rome and replaced by shoals of lascivious but more affluent industrialists. Is this not priceless? Money. Not frightfully important, as already stated. However, you will need a reasonable amount of the stuff to keep yourself presentably dressed, to take him out, to buy him a present, and to go off on an occasional jaunt if necessary. If you happen to be on the rich side, and if trade promises to be fairly brisk, you should seriously consider the idea of investing some capital in a garçonnière. The question of presents will be dealt with more thoroughly in another chapter. The gift of gab. Gays admire strong, silent cruisers, but are more often seduced by the loquacious. They love to talk and be talked to for hours on end. What to tell them to arouse their interest and mollify their heart will be explained separately further on. It's a technique that can be learned and developed. Here, as we are merely dealing what a cruiser must have, I will just underline the capital importance of the cruiser's tone of voice. A shrill, high-pitched, squeaky voice can utter the most subtly phrased, apt, ingenious, divine compliments without cutting any ice. On the other hand, the flattest platitudes, an extra boring dissertation on the comparative advantages of different physique magazines uttered in the dullest Oxford Dictionary manner, if uttered in low, melodious, self-confident, considerate, passionate voice, can awaken in your gay listener an interest, a sense of security and well-being. It can even make some sexual chords vibrate in unison so that you will have gotten to first base without even realizing it. Take singers. In private life, they are silly creatures, and when they open their mouths to sing either in a folk or variety show or a nightclub, they utter incredibly idiotic trash. But gays love them all the same, just because of their voice. In the course of this elementary handbook on cruising, I am never going to advise you to do setting-up exercises to develop your muscles or increase your stature, nor to go to expensive tailors, nor to dye your hair or undergo any beauty treatment. In other words, I don't want you to change your personality. On the contrary, I will try to teach you how to be spontaneous and extrovert, how to exaggerate your qualities and defects, how to be more yourself than you usually are. But in this question of the voice, I must make an exception. The voice is so important that should you happen to have an unfortunate one, I advise you to do something about it. Practice on it. Take it down on a tape recorder and listen to it to discover and correct the defects. Even go to the extreme of taking dictation lessons. It will be money well spent. I would even go further. Having a limited amount of cash to splash, it happens now and then to the best of us, I would say it is worth more in a voice improvement scheme than in a garçonnière. What is the point of a garçonnière if it's likely to stay empty? On the other hand, should you live in a foreign country, don't bother too much trying to polish your accent. A broken accent sounds exotic, and it can appeal to gays. Imagination. This is a bit more difficult. If you don't have much imagination, there isn't much you can do to acquire it. But you can still try to exercise it, and above all, study and copy those who do have one. the writers in the first place read a lot. Try and draw imaginary parallels between the situations in a novel and those in the real life that surrounds you. Place yourself in the position of a fictitious hero and try to imagine what your actions and reactions might be. A mental process a la Walter Mitty can help if it doesn't stay confined to daydreaming and if you can extract out of it hints for a romantic approach to gays. Gays adore the unusual. Apply your imagination to tell them unusual things. Give them unusual presents. Take them to unusual spots. Make love to them in an unusual way. Naturally, one must never overdo it. An old discarded locomotive is certainly an unusual present, but don't think it would be very much appreciated. A tour of the Paris sewers by boat is an unusual experience, but hardly the spot to tell Pierre or Alex that you adore him. Being made love to on the top of a tree could no doubt be an adventure out of the ordinary, but I doubt many gays would really enjoy it. Self-control. This I will explain more thoroughly when I deal with my minus one principle in a future chapter. At the present stage, I will confine myself to remarking that a successful cruiser must never lose his head completely. To be able to control the gay, he must first of all be able to control himself. It is difficult in certain circumstances and with certain gays, I quite agree, but it must be done if one wants to avoid the risk of seeing the roles reversed, of the cruiser becoming cruised. Cruelty. I am referring principally to mental cruelty. The inclinations of the Marquis de Sade do not interest us. The cruiser must keep the gay in a state of perpetual, even if mild, uncertainty and worry. He must be made to feel that he has not yet acquired a complete hold over him, but that he might do it in the end. His pride will be stimulated, and he will swear to himself that he will succeed where other gays have failed. To be able to apply such strategy, the cruiser will have to be evasive, unpredictable, moody. He will have to submit the gay to hot and cold sentimental showers, to alternate rather frequent periods of great affection, while others of relative indifference. Inevitably, he will be made to suffer, and this is why a certain amount of cruelty on the part of the cruiser is necessary. But this theme, too, will be developed more precisely later in our chapters. Acting. The ideal man does not exist, in the sense that not all gays, thank God, like the same type of man. Some like him gentle, and others prefer him brutal. Some treasure the shy one, others revere the bold. Some love mature men, others relish the young. Some fall for the brainy, others fancy the silly. Some gloat over the romantic, others prize the cynical. Some care for the introvert, others delight in the extro, and so on and so forth. It is obviously impossible for one single man to have all these qualities and defects. The accomplished cruiser, therefore, must first of all make a quick appraisal of the gay he is stalking and try to understand what type of man he prefers. Then he must make a decision. A. If it is clear that the gay likes his type, then naturally the solution is simple. The cruiser can just go ahead without bothering to act. Or B. Equally simple, if not so pleasant, is the solution in the case he realizes that the gay's ideal type is at the opposite pole of the cruiser's personality. He'd better give up, as no amount of acting, pretending, or camouflaging will get them to the equator, nor even the tropics. Finally, C. Between A and B, there are lots of intermediate situations which must be left to the intuition and discretion of the cruiser. In other words, he must decide whether the gap between the gay's ideal man and the man the cruiser really is can be filled. If the answer is in the affirmative, the acting capacities must be brought into action. Without ever completely travesting his true personality, the cruiser must enhance the characteristics that appeal to him and disguise or attenuate others that he hates. Some acting will again be essential when the minus one principle is applied. Nearly all actors you may have noticed are good cruisers, and vice versa. Very often, good cruisers have outstanding acting abilities. Discretion. As soon as your reputation as a homme à garçon is established, gays will be attracted to you by curiosity. They will try to get friendly with you to pump you about your adventures with other gays. They often will do this without any other second attention. And if the gays with whom you have had affairs happen to be friends of the ones we are talking about, the attraction will become almost irresistible. My advice in this case is one and one only: utmost discretion. Shut up like a clam. Don't let a word, a hint, an indirect or faint admission ever escape your trebly sealed lips. Lie, if necessary, and deny even the most obvious evidence. This will help you in two ways. In the first place, you will form the reputation, and in the right quarters, that is among gays, of being discreet and reliable, of not going around babbling and boasting about your conquests, of letting sleeping mates, lovers, fathers, mothers, brothers, and chaperones lie. The gays will feel more secure and will readily risk an adventure with you. In the second place, the details of your love affairs being left to imagination gossip will acquire legendary proportions and increase your lover status. Taste. Again, this is a difficult one. One is either born with a natural inclination toward good taste, or one has acquired it gradually by being brought up and living in the right environment. Failing these two assets, one can try to acquire good taste by observation, study, imitation. But it's hard going. Gays are natural aesthetes, and as a whole, they resent the vulgar, the gross, the gaudy, the harsh, the crude, the cacophonic. Fortunately, they are also emotional rather than rational, and once a man has succeeded in winning their heart over, they will forgive and forget a lot of things. They will even sometimes interpret the offenses committed by their man against good taste as endearing eccentricities. But don't be too sure, and don't overdo the eccentricities. There are limits even to a gay's love-distorted viewpoint. If you are not sure about your flair for clothes, better stick to the conventional. A dark gray suit, black shoes, white shirts, and a one-tone subdued tie can never go wrong. If you know nothing about furniture, carpets, paintings, better to call in an interior decorator. If you absorb your calories from cans or in drugstores, try to find out something about wines and the intricacies of a French menu before you take him to a smart restaurant. Good manners are in the same way related to good taste. Here my advice is very simple. Go through the whole bloody drill and don't be afraid of overdoing it. The preceding advice is almost superfluous for the American cruiser, who by and large is extremely well-mannered. But I have known several continental cruisers who have lost some mighty juicy bits for having forgotten their manners, especially with American gays who are utterly spoilt in this respect. I wish I knew what manners he was talking about. Just, like, the dessert fork? What manners? What are we talking about here? To this, as in all things, there are exceptions. Among the younger village generation of New York, and of the Via Marcuta in Rome, of the Munich artist quarters, of Chelsea and Bloomsbury in London, of the Left Bank in Paris and their equivalent in other cities all over the world, good manners are bad form. And now that we have seen, even if a bit vaguely and incompletely, what a cruiser must have, I would like a few serious words with you. Before you embark on the difficult, risky, but fascinating career of cruising, you should search your conscience, indulge in quite a bit of introspection, and decide what kind of cruiser you are going to be. Although there are practically infinite varieties, they can all be grouped into two main categories, the Casanovas and the Don Juans. The Casanova type falls in love quickly totally and desperately with all the gays he cruises or tries to cruise. The fact that he forgets them rapidly and that he can carry on an affair with two or three gays at the same time does not alter the fact. He is enthusiastic, generous, altruistic, and has for the gays a feeling of admiration, tenderness, gratitude, and even in his strange way of respect. In his tactics, he is rash, impetuous, and often tends to bungle things. He lies, of course, but most innocently, as at the time he tells his lies, he really believes in them. Well, nearly. He can accept defeat. Don Juan, by comparison, is even more obsessed by gays than Casanova. But he really doesn't love them. He only loves himself. He seeks in them the satisfaction of his lust and, above all, of his pride. He cannot accept defeat. He is more skilled, more subtled, more, I would say, scientific in his approach. He feels no pity, no consideration, no respect for his victims, and even derives a sadistic pleasure from their sufferings. He lies in cold blood. While Casanova can be happy and make his gays happy, even if for only short periods, Don Juan makes them unhappy and is himself always unsatisfied. He only enjoys the conquering and not the conquest. As soon as he has had a gay and Liporello has written his name down on the famous list, he becomes bored with him and starts looking for another one right away. The case of Don Juan is an extreme one. While Casanova and Oscar Wilde actually existed and related his adventures and feelings with great candor in his memoirs, the existence of Don Juan is historically debatable, and he is, as we know him, a literary character, the symbol of a mysterious force which compels men not only to chase gays, but also incessantly to defy both God and the devil. I would advise you to stick to Casanova. And that is Chapter 1 from The Beginner's Guide to Cruising by George Marshall, copyright 1964, from the Harry H. Weintraub collection of gay-related photography and historical documentation that is now part of the Human Sexuality Collection at Cornell University.